The freshest hits on the planet. The most music in the universe. 98.9 UFM.
Remember, you're on Unisa Radio, the African voice. It's all about you. Prof, let me welcome you. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Ignatius.
I must say, I'm glad that you made time to come and engage with us this afternoon.
Thank you, I'm delighted.
Also, who is Prof Sedat? You know, most of us see Prof on podiums, as I said, on articles, you know, all over the place, on TV, but people don't really understand who Prof Sedat is.
Let me firstly say I'm South African.
Proudly so.
Well, proudly so, because sometimes people think if you achieve a certain level, you cannot be South African, and so on. But I'm a South African, I'm a mother, I'm a woman, I grew up in Harankua. Yeah, so I'm an ordinary South African woman who's passionate about life, about causes, and about people. So I'm committed to South Africa and making it a better place in whichever way I can, in the small way that I can. I come from a very modest family. Obviously, life changes as we grow up. But I grew up in a context of poverty to an extent that people get surprised when they hear that I never spent more than 2 years in one school until I finished matric. It's only when I went to varsity that I spent more than 3 years in a school, or three or more years in a school. But that's because I grew up in a family. My mother was a domestic worker. And after they got married with my dad, they had three children. And then they took us to my grandmother, where we stayed in Marapiani, which is like...
Yeah.
And we stayed there whilst my mother went back to school to do Standard 5. I mean, she was a domestic worker. She worked at factories and, you know, obviously, she was lucky to get a husband, finally, you know, and who took her to school after that. So she went back to school to do Standard 5, having three children, went back into uniform whilst we stayed with my grandmother, both in school. So I actually grew up in a family with a mother who was studying, because after doing, she was studying just like us. So I've lived through all of that. I've lived through times when we ate pap and water and we put sugar and we used to get a skin disease. I don't know what you call it in English, but we used to get lekker krap and takama. Yes. I got all of those when I was young. I got takama, I got lekker krap. And that's what happens when you grow up in a poor family. It's because even though you have something to eat, pap and water is not nutritious enough. And so you don't have enough nutrition, so you get the skin diseases. So I've gone through all of that. So what I'm saying is that sometimes people look at a person and you don't really know where they are. Some students get surprised when I tell them where I come from, because they think, you know, life is easy. You wake up and things are right and you just get on. But in fact, it's not like that. We are not always what we look like. Our backgrounds are not what we look like.
And so as a daughter, how were you raised? Hampering in all these, you know, schools, getting from one school to the next, you know, getting from one village to the next village. Mm-hmm. How was it like for you and for you as a daughter in the family and outside the family? And how did, you know, your parents, you know, mold you, or rather treated you, or rather, you know, confined you to certain principles? Mm-hmm. How was it like, your experience?
I mean, my parents were very strict. And my mother still is. So they were very strict. There were things that were just a no-no, that you wouldn't even think about asking. I mean, partying was something you wouldn't even ask. They wouldn't, you know, you don't wait for them to say no, so you wouldn't ask. Education was very important. My dad made rules that everyone has to go to university. He didn't care what you were going to do. And one day he said to me, if you want to make tea, you're going to learn how to make tea at university. I don't care. You know, so nobody is going to a technical or a college or whatever. Everyone goes to university. And that was clear from very early age. You knew that had to happen. Being smart in my parents' eyes was the most important thing. My dad used to have a practice on weekends. Like, he would have his friends coming and they're drinking. My sister and I are very close. I mean, the three of us, we have only 1 year in between. So we like, same age, you know. But and so my younger sister and I, I'm the one in the middle. So my sister and I grew up like twins, and he would call us and he would put us there, and they're sitting in the lounge, and he would say to his friends, my children are very, very smart. I want you to ask them any question, and let me assure you, they will answer it correctly.
Okay.
And you're just hoping whatever they ask you, you get it. But then, of course, you didn't want to disappoint. Yes. Or because then you'll get it. Once they are gone, you'll be in so much trouble. Because being smart was very important.
Yeah. So when I look at, you know, on the three that you just gave us now, you know, you come from a normal family which is not rich, you know, more or less you could say they were middle class family because they were working class.
Well, they were working class. I mean, middle class is what I am now.
Okay. But they were working class. Okay.
They were working class.
Let's
definitely
say they were working class.
Yeah.
Typical black sort of working Absolutely. Class family. But you know, your parents were very ambitious. You know, so I say
yes.
They allow that none of you guys, only three of you, will actually, you know, aim at going to technical, but you guys should aim at going to universities.
Yeah.
More especially the then, as I said, when you look at the political landscape of then, mm-hmm. you know, it was not even easy for you to go to universities. But nonetheless, your parents made a point that, you know, you guys went to university, or rather, you guys, you know, would dream to go to university.
But you know, let me tell you something. It's because my dad had this belief that education is the only route out of oppression.
Mm.
I mean, he was convinced that, you know,
the only way you
if black people get educated, then
that's it.
I mean, he used to tell us about the white people that he was working with. And he used to say, I don't want you to be in that situation.
Yes.
If you have the education, you can be the boss.
The passion for mathematics, who inspired Mama Katie to even say, go for mathematics out of all things?
You never know what you really like until it happens. But when I was doing Standard 5, I was doing Standard 5 at a school where my mother taught. The principal was teaching us maths. He was an elderly man. This principal decided to put me in competition with Mommy, who I didn't know. And he was very strict. So every time we wrote a test, he always said to me, you can do better, you can do better. And then he used to bring the scripts, Mommy's scripts. He was very bright.
Oh.
Mommy's scripts, if Mommy gets an 80, I either have to get an 80 or more.
Yes.
And that was the route. I mean, I was competing with this person who I didn't know. I ultimately met her when we were doing matric. But, you know, and that's what sort of gave me a sense that I could do it. You know, when Mr. Mutiang always brought and said, and he used to say, Mutlana, Mommy got 80%.
And he didn't know
how
who his mommy is.
No, I didn't. He said, Mommy got 80%. How can you get 60? You know, how can you get... And then he would do that and beat me up. Because at that time, corporal punishment was the order of the day.
Yeah.
And they used to punish us at that time, not for failing, but for getting lower than what you got the last time.
Oh.
Exactly. So and then I realized, actually, maths is an... is the easiest way to pass because the other subjects required me to memorize. And my parents, all they could say was, you must study hard, stay away from boys. You know, that's the big advice you get. Stay away from boys and study hard. That's all. You know, and all I could do was just bury myself in books.
Mm-hmm. So when did you start for POF? You know, your first job by the year of 1988 when you started teaching.
Yeah.
How did you start? How was it like?
It
coming
was
from university, you know, being young, being energetic, I'm thinking
you're
going to teach mathematics, something that you'd really like. How was the experience?
It wasn't planned, by the way. I had planned to go to university and do my honors at Wits.
Oh.
But then that year, I didn't have funding. So then I decided, okay, I'll go and teach. And I just worked at Hebron. Now had a new building. And I thought, I went to school there. There was no matrics anymore. And I thought, I'm going to the college. They probably need someone like me. So I just walked in and I said, I've got my degree and I need a job. They said, what do you teach? I said, mathematics. And they called me to an office, the director and the two vice rectors, and they did an interview and they said, fine, you hired. So there I was. I was 21. Half the students are older than me.
Yes.
I mean, not only am I young, I'm stupid and naive.
I'm thinking, what sense?
Yeah, I mean, I was stupid and naive in every which way. But all I knew was mathematics, and I want to teach it. Finish. Actually, Professor Mozart was also a lecturer there when I got there. I found her there, and I stayed 1 year and I left.
Professor Mozart.
Professor Mozart is a professor in human sciences. She was teaching English there at Hebron. I found her there. Yeah, the students that I taught respected me. I mean, the thing is, I am small. But I don't take rubbish, you know. And once people start working with me, they realize I'm nice. But you know, you can't play around with me.
Reservations.
Yeah, you can't play around with me. So the students like me a lot. The problem was the students who I didn't teach. that's where the problem was, because you know, I was just teaching math, so I only had access to
mathematics students,
and I was teaching first years, I think. Used to do stuff like that.
1990, you know, professor was appointed active principal, and I'm thinking at a very young age by then, how was the experience as well being, you know, being appointed in management by then,
yeah,
you know, as an acting
it principal. Was a surprise. I mean, I come from Harangua, I go to Fochville, they say there's this new school. You know, I had spent a year at this, now there's this new school, I, you know, so they say, well, they are interviewing teachers for the school. I go, I stand in the queue just like everyone, and the interviewers, I'm thinking, well, I'm just being interviewed as a teacher. The following day they phone me, they say, yes, you've been appointed and we would like you to act as principal.
And then it went on and on up until you then, you know, were appointed advisor in mathematics in the region. Actually.
No, I after that I then got a permanent job as head of department at a high school.
Oh.
Because that school was new in Fochville. It was the year in which I became the principal, I was starting the school. There was no building, nothing. I was principal of a school that had no building, had a name and teachers and students.
No resources.
And they were grade 8 and 9. Yeah, they were grade 8 and 9 or grade 7 and 8, something like that. And every year, the idea was that the school grows. We were doing platoon system. You know platoon system? Yo.
That is.
One group comes in the morning, the other group comes
later.
I did that at grade 1. When I was in grade 1, that's what we did. Now here I am, principal of a platoon school. So we used to start at 12 because there was no building. So other students come in. The primary school comes in 8 to 12, 12 o'clock we start. I mean, you start school. By the time you start, half the kids are drunk, eh?
Yes.
I mean, they're high school kids. I mean, I remember one used to sell coal, you know. You know, if I come early to school, I come at 10 or whatever, I see him selling coal. 12 o'clock he's there, you know. Yes. So in the morning he's working, you know. So it was very interesting. So I was acting principal, but I was also teaching maths in the whole school. There was no math teacher, so I was teaching maths in the whole school.
And you moved to another school as well.
As a head of department now. Now, that wasn't an acting position. I was appointed as a permanent head of department of mathematics in Randfontein now.
Yes.
Yeah. And I did that. I didn't do that long. I mean, it's like, you know, my life moved quite fast. I did that for about 18 months, I think. And then I applied for a job as a subject advisor mathematics in the West Rand. So working with teachers in the whole of the West Rand, and at that time it was from Western area, Krugersdorp, Carltonville, up to Carltonville.
I understand that, you know, that the prof has a passion for working with people.
Yes.
You know, I realize that for having, you know, got a position, you know, a permanent position as an advisor, and you move to an NGO,
yes,
you know, somebody would want to know what actually, you know, pushed the professor to actually move to an NGO from a permanent position. Because I'm thinking, dynamics were quite different by then.
Yeah.
You know, from salary to everything, you know, from resources to everything. And you moved to an NGO. But clearly it paid off. You know, clearly it paid off. Because at the end of the day today, we're saying that I could, you know, literally say working with people and empowering people actually worked for you, professor. Mm. You know, why the move to an NGO?
I've made many decisions in my career where some people thought it was stupid. Because firstly, you're right. Permanent job, I was moving to a contract. Because NGOs, money is not certain. And but then, you know, it was 94. I moved just after the elections. You know, things were complicated, and I felt we have a new government, there's new energy. Do I want to sit in this department, you know, of the old government? Because that was the Department of Education and Training. And I decided, no. I thought, I'm young, I can still do this. You know, if it doesn't work, I'll find another job in a stable, whatever. And I remember my director saying to me, I don't think it's a good decision you're making. So, I'm going to keep your resignation letter. If you change your mind, just call.
In case you want to come back.
Yeah. So, and he said that, and I said, thank you, sir. I worked for was Count. And Count still exists, but Count used to work only in Gauteng. But what attracted me to Count, Count only did maths, but we only worked with teachers in the farm schools. Phew, what an experience. It was an area where I thought, I want to contribute to this. And I knew about Count when I was a subject advisor, because the schools that I worked with as a subject advisor were township schools and they were farm schools, they were rural schools. No, I did study. I studied part-time. I did my master's part-time at VETS. I used to go and attend classes. I did my PhD in the same way. Well, within the PhD, I did take 1 year where I took leave without pay because I was working at CCD, at the NGO, the other NGO. So I asked them to give me leave without pay because they wouldn't pay me. I had just only been working for them for 1 year. So I took leave without pay. I didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, it's nice to be young, you know. You just get a call, you jump.
You always took risks.
I took risks, yeah. So I said to them, I'll come back after a year. And the director wasn't happy, and he said, no, she said 6 months, you know. So I said, fine, you know. And I went to vets. That 1 year I did my proposal, you know, and I did quite a lot of work that year. And then I got an opportunity to work as a research assistant in one of the research projects. And that helped quite a lot because I got the love of academia. I mean, the NGO was paying me very well. That's the year, 1998, when I decided I'm going to academia.
And vets, you know, you went and worked for vets as well.
Yeah, and yeah. Well, I was doing my PhD at vets, and I became a research assistant in a research group at vets.
And I'm thinking, you know, this is so not so long ago, you know.
Yeah,
I liked when you said that, you know, your life moved actually quite fast.
Yes.
I guess that is obviously be determined by the decision that you take in life.
Yeah.
So a lot of young people could actually learn a lot from you in terms of when one is taking decision. You know, you always had the conscious mind of saying, I want to do this, and you always followed your instincts in doing it. And today it led you somewhere.
Yeah.
You worked as a researcher, and, you know, you were recognized as one of the best researchers in the country, you know, and I'm thinking that it paid off.
Yeah.
It paid off for you. I'm going to go back to your passion, Prof, of working with people. You know, when you worked with the Tsoga Uitirele Matanyane project, which won an award. That was actually quite interesting as well.
That was the best time of my life working with the women.
Working with women. Yeah. So you actually on a daily basis you try very much to push for women empowerment in society. What inspired this project?
You know, that project started whilst I was working at CCD. South African Brewery said they want to run a women empowerment project. They didn't know what to do. They said, we've got the money, we want people to run it in all the provinces. I was doing mathematics. So I was in this meeting and I said, I will do Limpopo.
Out of the blue.
I didn't know what I was going to do. But I just thought, working with women... These are not math teachers. These are illiterate women
in the rural
area. Yes. And I thought, it's a learning opportunity I can't let go of. So I just said, I'll do Limpopo. Absolutely. Yeah. The women I worked with in Limpopo didn't even know that I have a master's degree.
Hmm.
I mean, they didn't know even that I've been a teacher. They just saw me coming in and I sat down with them. I used to wear the hele every time I was there because I got to look like that.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
I just made a decision. These women, I have to get a buy-in from working with people, with these women. Every time you work with people, I always think, how do we get a buy-in from people? If I'm gonna play high and mighty, nobody's gonna hear me.
Yes.
Okay, and I realized they can actually dismiss me because I'm young.
Mm.
So I wear the hele. I sat down with them. There were some workshops where I said,
level.
Yeah, and some workshops I let them run, and I told them they must teach me about cars. So you had I had to do my own program. So I had sections on multiculturalism, you know, Bill of Rights, women's rights, constitution, whatever. Before I taught them about, because the brief was that in a year, I have to make sure that the women have an income-generating project. So, but I thought...
Real financial empowerment.
Yeah, but before you get to teaching them about how to make money, you've got to teach them to appreciate who they are. Who they are as women, as black people, as South Africans, as whatever. They should never look them down on themselves simply because they live in a rural area.
Or they live in the midst of poverty.
Exactly.
Well.
So I therefore structured a program in that way and worked with them on all these matters that I felt served their empowerment.
The year 2004, Prof, you know, started a project, Adopt the Learner Project, which I believe is one of the most extraordinary things that, you know, the Prof you have done. You know, you just didn't look at empowering women as it is, but you even went on and say, I'm going to empower young people.
Yeah.
How has the project been going thus far?
The project is going great. I mean, there's challenges, you know. I mean, I stress. One of the students fails, I get worried.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I still support students in Harankua. I had two in KwaZulu-Natal. the one in KwaZulu-Natal, one of them from KwaZulu, they were brother and sister. The brother is a vet. He's completing this year.
Huh?
And that's my second boy. Naturally, I've got one real son, my son, blood son. My other son is this one who also is I support from through my adopted learner that I got from there. The other learners are in Kharankua. They're still in high school.
So how do you prof, you know,
how do I work that?
Yeah, how do you initially see that, okay, this can be a project to be molded, this can be something to work with? How do you identify them and you know, in making
different ways, you know, different ways in Kharankua? What I did, I haven't selected new kids in about two years, but in Kharankua what I did, I just gave them a test at one of the schools where I went to Totebe. I just give them, I give a test to the whole school. And then I mark the test. And obviously the results are not fantastic. And it's maths. It's all maths because I want children who have potential in maths. So they don't have to be getting 100%. But as long as I see some potential, then I select them. Those who have potential, then once they are on my team, then I get my students to support them. Because I've got PhD students and master students who I support, pay for their funds, for their fees. So those students then pay me by helping my learners at school, because I just don't have the time to do it all the time. So, but it's the chain that I'm trying to develop, that I'm supporting you as a PhD or a master's student to pay your fees and make sure you go to conference, you get developed. You can then support the younger ones and teach them maths at the times when you're ready. And we are recognized for innovation in mathematics and science education.
Wow. So Prof, how do you manage all this?
The truth is that there are things that I don't do that maybe people spend time on. I also work very long hours. I mean, I sleep very little. I get to my office at 5:30. It doesn't look like it when you're looking at me now, but I've been in my office since 5:30
in the morning.
In the morning. And I leave at around 8 o'clock. You know, my son is big. He's at varsity. My adopted son stays at rest, at vets. He prefers to stay at rest. My son prefers to stay at home. So I can afford to do that because I don't have little babies. I don't have toddlers and whatever to run to. So I work very, very short hours. I'm much more disciplined than I used to be. That I used to work, I mean, before I came to UNISA, I used to work on Saturdays and Sundays. I was at work. Christmas, I used to stop working on the 23rd, and then on the 27th, I'm back at work, and on the 2nd, I'm back. You know, I was one of those crazy people. I don't do that anymore. Weekends, I don't come to the office. I try that my hardest not to come, and I take leave much more than I did before. So at least the end of the year, I do take leave, and I still take my iPad, you know, and work a bit, but not as crazy as before. But the point is that I understood very early in my life the value of time, the economy of time. Yes. I think many people don't recognize the economy of time, and I say to people, if you understand the economy of time, then you will accomplish much.
Mm.
Because there's a lot of time that people waste on things that are not necessary.
You know, to keep you guys updated, Professor, I'm still speaking to Professor Setati, very well known as Mamokheti. And Professor is actually the first black African woman in South Africa to obtain a PhD in mathematics education, and the first black South African to have a paper published in the Journal for Research in Mathematics Education. And the Prof has more than 30 published articles in journals, books, and conference proceedings, and is the first and only author in 23 of this. You know, if you were to advise, you know, how could we go about changing the education system in the country for the better?
Okay. I mean, I agree that education needs attention in the country, but I don't think that attention is changing curricula. Mm. I think changing curricula is barking up the wrong tree. I mean, I think the big thing that we need is professionalization of teaching and teachers. I think that's a big task. That starts with how you treat teachers, how you regard them, where they stay. I mean, we need to professionalize teachers. The way we treat teachers will also make them realize the standing that they have in the society, in the community, and so on. Because we also need some discipline there in terms of the teachers seeing what's their role in this in education. You know, I mean, it's a pity that we have many people who are teachers who actually, if they had a choice, wouldn't choose to be teachers.
Yes.
I mean, it would be good if we had teachers who, every teacher, I mean, there's lots of good teachers out there, but there's many who don't want to be there, but they are there because there's nothing else to do.
They're subjected to go there.
Exactly. So if you had teachers who said, I know I don't have to be here, but I'm here because I want to be here. I love it and I want to make a difference. Just like we went to Saltsville today. I know I don't have to be there. But I went there because I want to make a contribution. Yeah. I want, you know. If we have that, we can change. Because if you have that, even with the worst curriculum in the world, you'll see a huge change.
You know, as she says, she's human. She's not a superwoman. So it's very easy to actually engage the professor. You know, go on her website, www.mamokheti.com. But nonetheless, you remember your own news and radio, the African voice. It's all about you. Know this, economy of the time is very crucial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ignatius.
The freshest hits on the planet. The most music in the universe. 98.9 UFM.